Welcome, curious souls, to the Macabre Emporium, your sanctuary for the unusual, the mysterious, and the appalling.
Step through our cryptic doorway into a world where secrets whisper and enigmas come to life.
I'm David.
And I'm Sarah.
Together, we're your custodians of the macabre, guiding you through tales that defy the ordinary.
Discover the untold stories, from lesser-known cases of true crime to the bizarre events that captivate us.
Join us on a journey to the shadows where the mainstream fades and the extraordinary beckons.
So whether you seek the bizarre, the eerie, or the chillingly obscure,
you're in for a treat here at Macabre Emporium.
Welcome back to Macabre Emporium. This is episode 75.
And if this is your first time joining us, either from Twitch or recommendations or whatever, from Leonard and Steven from the West of Nowhere podcast.
Oh.
Welcome.
Welcome.
It's actually Shane and Levi. It's an ongoing joke. But anyway, welcome.
Welcome.
So, nothing too exciting has been going on with us.
Nope, not a thing.
Just surviving like everybody else, but it's an episode this week of just me, no combined episode.
It's a David-sode. Yeah, we decided to stay on track since we missed last week, which I'm sure you guys can guess that we didn't do an episode on 9/11 just because there's enough, you know, sadness and trauma that day alone. So
And then I came up with a great idea for an episode, and then we couldn't find the third person for it, which I did find one later on from one of the people I met through streaming on Twitch. He was in the first grade when it happened. I was like, God damn, you would have been perfect for us to have on.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Yeah. At any rate, we decided to take last week off. So we're back.
Yep.
Yay.
So, like I said, it's a David-sode this week, or Sarah said it's a David-sode this week.
It's a David-sode.
But I have true crime. But
I didn't ask.
I know. So go ahead and ask now, and then we'll do it over.
No, just leave it like that.
Okay.
With me being like,
so since
you
even didn't ask, I have true crime this week, but it's not my normal mass shooter type true crime.
Okay.
It's a kidnapping.
Oh.
But a very bizarre one in sorts.
Okay.
And I'm kind of hoping this pisses you off, like you decide to bring in two stories to piss everybody off two weeks in a row.
I did not
without
do that
trying.
On purpose.
I know you didn't do it on purpose, but just the reasoning why they did this and whatnot, I kind of hope it irritates the shit out of you. Because of 2 weeks in a row of that from you.
Thanks. So you set out to annoy me.
Well, and not like, not on purpose, but once I read more into this, I was like, I hope the whole outcome of this really irritates the shit out of her.
Okay. Fair.
But first, for September 18th, are on this day. Actor James Gandolfini is born in Westview, New Jersey. Gandolfini is best known for his role in The Sopranos as Tony Soprano. The Addams Family premiered on ABC in 1955 and ran for two seasons. The original show starred John Astin as Gomez, Jackie Coogan as Uncle Fester, and Carolyn Jones as Morticia. The most famous ragtime composition was granted copyright in 1899, and that is the Maple Leaf Rag by Scott Joplin. You might not know it by name, but I'm sure if you hear it, you'll know what I'm talking about. In 1990, Atlanta, Georgia would be selected to be the host city of the Centennial Summer Olympics that will be held in 1996.
What's centennial?
100 years.
Oh, okay.
Momofuku Ando marketed the first cup of noodles packaging in a waterproof styrofoam cup in 1971.
Cup of noodles?
Yep.
I love those things.
4 years later, Patty Hearst is captured by the FBI in San Francisco, California. Hearst was kidnapped a year earlier by a far-left group for ransom and eventually became a member, most noted for taking part of a robbery by the group.
Huh.
Jimi Hendrix dies at the age of 27 in London, England, from asphyxia while intoxicated on barbiturates. He is buried in Greenwood Memorial Park in Renton, Washington.
Damn.
That is our On This Day for September 18th, 2024.
On This Day for today is death.
Not much else to say other than it's true crime, and it's a unique true crime thing, so, you
that's
know,
your thing.
Right.
Is I the figured, unique stuff.
Right, and everybody's going to be like, oh, God, true crime from David, but like I already said, no, it's not a mass shooter this time like usual.
Which is out of your wheelhouse.
I know. Somebody did suggest this to me, and I don't remember who it was.
I feel like it was either my sister or Jerry from
Possibly. But I'm going to be telling everybody about the Chowchilla school bus kidnapping in 1976. So if you're listening to this, and if you suggested this to me, please let me know. So, and then if you ever suggest something, I'm going to try and make notes on who does this so I can thank you guys when we do the episodes.
I really feel like it was Jerry from Hillbilly Horror Stories.
It could have been. I don't remember.
I feel like it was. I'll have to go back and re-listen.
Maybe.
And see.
But anyhow, are you ready to get started?
Yep.
All right, well, let's get going then. So, first of all, we're going to talk about Chowchilla, California first, just to kind of get an idea how much of an impact this had on the town itself.
Okay.
Chowchilla, California was founded in 1844 by John Fremont and is 40 miles northwest of Fresno, California. It is named after the Chowchilla River, which is believed to be too mean, river or to flow, in a rough translation from the Yokut tribe that inhabited the San Joaquin Valley area where Chowchilla is.
Mm-hmm.
Economy of Chowchilla is agriculture. Major crops of Chowchilla are almonds, grapes, citrus fruits, vegetables, and cotton, along with many dairy farms. In 1976, when this took place, Chowchilla's population was only about 5,000 residents compared to its 20,000 today in 2024.
Oh.
When you hear the number of people involved in this kidnapping, you can see how much of an impact it had on a community of only 5,000 people. It is also described as a close-knit community where they never locked their doors and everyone always looked out for everybody. So it's kind of more like your Pleasant Town, USA kind of thing.
Not this area.
Or the town that Dennis the Menace lived in or whatever.
Right.
So on July 15th, 1976, bus driver Frank Ed Ray, which I'm going to call him Ed, was bringing back 26 students from a day of swimming as a field trip from summer school at the fairgrounds before returning to the school Dairyland Elementary. Ed Ray was described as a strong and quiet man. Everyone liked and respected him from the now adults that I watched videos on this.
Mm-hmm.
After 4 p.m., a white van was end up blocking the road of the bus that Ed Ray was driving right at a stop sign. Ed started to go around the van when three men wearing nylon stockings over their faces exited the van and demanded Ed to open the door.
It's always a white van.
All right, so maybe this is one of those origin things where the white van gets started.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. One of these two would actually drive the bus, held Ed Ray at gunpoint with a sawed-off double-barreled shotgun, while the third tailed behind in the now hijacked bus. The three ones driving the white van behind.
Because
I worded that really stupid. The kids didn't know what was going on, but they knew something was wrong because Ed kept telling them to sit down and be quiet in a very harsh tone, and they knew something wasn't right because he never talked to the kids this way.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out some of the stuff on how small of a space this all happened in. So the fairgrounds are only 6 miles away from the elementary school, but they ended up driving this now hijacked bus 7 miles out of town to an area known as Brenda, which is a wetland in the area. And they would hide the bus in a field of bamboo, and one of the survivors remembered it being taller than the bus, and this is also where the kidnappers would retrieve their second van.
So they have two vans?
Yes, they have two vans.
Okay.
And there's 26 children and one adult on this bus.
They didn't have, like, bus helpers back then?
No. This was in 1976.
Okay.
So it was probably just a bus driver, and that was it. Kidnappers planned to transfer the kids from the school bus to their vans. It's more like how they move cattle. So they would have the doors open on their bus and back the van to the door of the bus.
So they didn't have any room to escape.
So they can use the doors as a corral, basically, like they would... cattle coming off.
So I'm assuming this would be like the back door of the bus and then the main side door.
They didn't really specify. They just said the door of the bus. But the kidnappers would also tell the kids to jump from the bus to the van so they wouldn't leave any footprints. Which doesn't make any fucking sense because your motherfucking footprints are going to be goddamn ground plus tire marks.
And also they're going to see the bus number on the bus and know what kids are assigned to that bus.
Right. That's if they tracked kids on buses like that in back in the 70s.
I guess.
Who knows? Maybe this is one of those things that actually did.
Oh, okay. Maybe.
Jody Heffington, one of the kids that was loaded into the second van, said that she was stopped by one of the kidnappers by putting a shotgun to her stomach while the second van was moved into the place to load them in. She said that she was like, "I'm doing what you told us to do," and she was for sure that he was going to shoot her. And all he was basically doing was just holding them in place while the second van came in to herd them into the second one. There are two vans. One van was painted white. The other one was either black or green. It varied from sources. These kidnappers installed soundproof padding to the interiors and put like wood paneling over the side of it. So yeah, it's kind of a very 70s-ish bus, but they, you know, put all the soundproof padding in it so they can't draw attention while they're driving. And they also blacked out all the windows.
Of course they did.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, this is your typical kidnapper white van that we all joke about these days, basically. After the children and Ed were loaded into the vans, they did then take them to California Rock and Gravel, a quarry roughly 110 miles from the fairgrounds in Livermore, California. And there you have, like, no light, no ventilation in the back of these vans. So, it just seemed even longer than the drive really was. Hours later, approximately around sundown, is when a law enforcement pilot noticed the van in the in this bamboo field, because, you know, by 3 o'clock, parents are starting to, hey, my kids aren't home. I'm going to call down the street. Hey, is little Tommy home? No, he's not home.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, they basically played the telephone game, basically trying to find out where these kids are. And I'm sure everyone's saying, no, no, no. And then, oh, well, Susie's not home either. You know, so they all started getting concerned, and then they, you know, called. Like, hey, my kid's not home yet, and all this stuff. Because, you know, playing that telephone game, they started searching around the school's bus route that they were supposed to go to, knowing they were going to the pool, and they were supposed to come back and drop the kids off. So they started searching around the route to see if they could find anything. But this pilot is the one that found the bus hiding in the bamboo, because the pictures I saw, it's literally probably a good another 6 to 8 feet over the top of the bus.
The bamboo?
Yes.
Damn.
So they never would have spotted it from the road.
I didn't know that bamboo grew in California.
I didn't either until I read about this, but the climate is probably about the same in, Eastern countries where it grows wild. I mean, I'm sure it grows wild now in certain parts of California now because of being planted there. Sheriff Ed Bates knew this was serious, and he called the governor of California requesting help in locating the children and Ed. He would end up getting at least 30 FBI agents along with state police. I mean, you got 26 kids and one adult missing without a trace, and then suddenly find the bus in a bamboo field with nobody around, no signs of where they went.
Yeah, that'd be definitely a little odd to stumble upon.
Right. And then during the time that they were missing, like some of the news reports, somebody asked, do you think this isn't like a prank or a hoax of some sort? And it's like, someone's like, well, I kind of hope that's all this really is, but... Who would be like, hey, let's kidnap, you know, let's pull a giant prank on these parents and just, like, hide 26 children.
And the bus driver.
And, of course, yes, also the bus driver. So when they finally did get to the quarry, the kidnappers would quickly take each kid and Ed out one by one by opening the doors just long enough to grab whatever kid was closest to them and then shut the doors again. Most of the people that I did see that were interviewed for this, they said that they first thought they were all being killed off one by one because when the doors would open, they couldn't see any of their classmates. The kidnappers would take the names of each of the kids, and Jody would first tell them that her name was Puddin' Tame, as being the same, and I'll tell you the same, being a smartass about it. And, you know, the kidnappers were like, if you do that again and don't tell us your name, you'll never see your mom and dad again. The kidnappers weren't killing these kids off, thankfully. What they were doing...
The way you said that, I'm worried now.
No. I mean, events later on, if they didn't happen, it would have been much worse. So what they were doing is they were forcing every one of them into a makeshift underground bunker made from a tractor trailer about 12 feet underground.
And this was in the quarry?
Yep. They did cut makeshift toilets into the wheel wells of this trailer and supplied them with very little food and water and a stack of mattresses. The survivors remember hearing fans running also for some kind of ventilation that was inside their trailer/bunker. Michael Marshall, who was 14 at the time of the kidnapping, would remember hearing everyone shouting, it's Mike, when he was forced down the ladder into the trailer with the rest of his classmates before the youngest at the time, 5-year-old Monica Artie, was being the last child to come down this ladder. He also did say that he couldn't stand the thought of letting them take Monica from him, and since they were the last two in the van, and him being the oldest in this van with the majority of the younger kids, they all turned to him for comfort, and he remember telling her it would be okay while he had to pry her hand from his as they pulled him out of the van to force him down the bunker. So after Monica came down the ladder, the kidnappers pulled it back up and threw down some toilet paper and told them, we'll be back for you, before they sealed up the opening with a manhole cover and placed sheet metal and batteries that weighed about 100 pounds on top. So we're talking like big truck industrial size batteries.
So it's, I'd imagine it's dark as fuck in there.
Mm-hmm.
And they just throw on toilet paper and then cover it so they have no light to see where the toilet paper went.
I didn't see anything about lights or anything, but what they, a lot of them said, it was just dark, pitch black. With, you know, fight or flight now kicking in, Michael and Ed, the bus driver, are now trying to search for a way out, even though they tried to move the manhole cover and weren't able to. Michael would say it would be silent in the bunker and someone would start crying in the pitch black and everyone else would start crying. He said the thing that made him cry was not being able to say goodbye to his mom while remembering the last time he didn't see her. And he didn't go into details of what it was. He just got very emotional, you know, reliving all this.
Mm-hmm.
By this point, they had already been in the ground for 12 hours already. And the fans had stopped running and the food has already ran out at this point. So, I mean, you only have one adult, 26 kids. It's going to be trying hard to maintain the food. But, you know, they're already immediately trying to find a way out of this.
Yeah.
Out of the situation they're in. Okay. Larry Park, who was 8 years old at the time, remembers one of the boys that started kicking the blocks out from under one of the 4x4 posts that the kidnappers put inside to reinforce the roof as it started to cave in. He remembers some of the other kids just started screaming and crying while the van started to bow inward from the weight above, and he thought he was going to die, but this was actually a blessing in disguise, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Because now it kind of makes it easier for them to try and escape. Determined that this wouldn't be their final resting place, Ed and Michael and the rest of the kids started to stack the mattresses on top of each other to reach the manhole cover while Michael is able to finally get it to move with the encouragement of the other kids to find himself standing inside of a wooden box on top of the trailer. And this box is only big enough just for him to stand up, and he just starts digging. And while he's digging, he's like getting exhausted already trying to push the manhole cover because he basically gives a piece of wood to wedge an opening between the manhole cover and the top of the trailer, and that's how he was able to weasel his way in and out, basically.
Okay.
Even though when he was digging, he was scared that he just started digging and he didn't know how far he had to go, but he was scared out of his mind the whole time that he was for sure that the kidnappers would be up there waiting with guns in hand and digging.
I would have thought that too.
But they're in the middle of a giant quarry, basically, and you know, those places go out hundreds of miles or whatever, because I mean, we drive past them all over the places we go. Who knows? Larry Park would remember the sudden rays of light and the fresh air rushing in from when Michael finally broke through to the surface, basically. And he just described it like seeing the dust in the air with the sunlight coming in. It looked like shooting stars, basically. And this was the moment that they knew they were free. And they spent a total of 16 hours inside that trailer and freed themselves by the next day of July 15th. So once they finally came out of their temporary prison, basically, at this point, all they could see were hills and the equipment from the quarry and that they were being held captive in. And the employees saw them and came rushing up to you guys like, who are you guys? That knowing that they were all kidnapped, because this is like 100 miles away.
Yeah.
Could have been not on the nightly news or morning news there yet, because news traveled slower than it does now.
I feel like news got around pretty quickly in the 70s.
Right. I mean, you gotta think about also Bath Township. Planes were flying in from Chicago into Bath, Michigan, and that was the first time a lot of them even saw planes once they heard about that stuff. Quarry workers finally realized who they were. Obviously, they called the sheriff's department. It's like, hey, we got this man and these like 26 kids up here. We think that, you know, they're the ones that were kidnapped, basically. But, you know, that first quarry employee might not have known what was going on when they were like, who are you guys? What are you guys doing here? This is not a place for kids.
I mean, they were able to tell them who they were and what happened, right?
Oh, I'm sure they did at that point. And then that's when they're like, oh, shit, we need to call the sheriff's department. The sheriff's department, once they arrived, they took pictures of all the kids and took photos of each one of the kids, and they transported them to the Santa Rita Rehabilitation Center. This is the local jail for this area.
They took them to the jail?
Because it was the closest facility that had medical.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. I'm like, yeah, why'd they take them to the jail?
Let me finish sometimes first.
No, you do that to me all the time.
Yeah, but usually when I do that, it's like I spoil it for myself without trying. So this jail is, you know, like I said, this is like the closest place with medical facilities. And like, if you look up pictures for a lot of this, even like the pictures that the sheriff's department took at the quarry, you can like, they're somewhat dirty. They're kind of cut and scraped up, but a lot of them are smiling and whatnot still. But it's knowing that they're safe now is what a lot of it is. And the pictures in the jail, which is kind of interesting because you can see them wearing the Santa Rita Rehabilitation Prison white shirts and whatnot, and they're like laughing and carrying on like it's their lunch hour, basically. Just to go from one extreme end of the emotions, you know, like that within like a 16-hour period, basically. So while they're at the rehabilitation center or jail, they would end up spending like a total of 4 hours of doing interrogation, basically answering questions from the sheriff's department. It's like, you know, we got to get all the details, what they look like, this and other, but like it's kind of hard to give them a facial description because they have the nylon pantyhose over their head, so all your facial features are squished up, you know. I never really thought people actually did that. I always thought that was like a Hollywood thing, you know.
Apparently.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm pretty sure a lot of guys probably got side-eyed in the 70s and 80s, you know, buying the egg called legs, or I think it was called legs or whatever.
Two G's. Legs. Oh, my God. Yeah, I remember those.
Well, you know, or they're probably like, it's California. They're probably like, eh, whatever. And they would finally be reunited with their parents after 36 hours later, and they were put on a Greyhound bus because they were 100 miles away. So they got a police escort on a Greyhound bus from the jail back to Chowchilla, California. And this is also to believe the biggest mass kidnapping in the United States to date.
That's crazy.
So let's talk about the three dipshits that did this.
Okay, hear it.
So the first one is 24-year-old Frederick Newall Woods, the son of the owner of the quarry, and would become the first, like, a person of interest, like, immediately, because once they unearthed the trailer, they're like, somebody has had to have access to this place at all hours of the day to be able to pull this fucking off.
Yeah.
Because after questioning, you know, quarry employees is like, well, we keep seeing three guys digging off on parts of the quarry, but probably pay no attention to it. My assumption would be is like that might have been a new employee, not knowing who Frederick Woods was, you know, him being the son of the owner is my assumption or best guess for that
you
situation.
You would think three people digging in your quarry and you have no idea who they are. If somebody walks in my building at work, somebody, one of the staff, if it's not me, is immediately at the door asking what they could help them with. You know, what are you here
but
for?
This is a rock quarry compared to what you do. There's a, like a bigger deal of security with what you do.
Right.
But this is also the mid 70s where everyone was like, mind your business. Which people need to learn that today, because it's like noise in neighbor groups. It's like, do you guys know where their sirens are? If it's not at your house, don't fucking worry. Stop being so nosy.
True. Although it wouldn't be a nosy neighbors group if they weren't being nosy.
Oh, I understand that, but still, it's just like mind your damn business.
Mind your business.
And they were digging like months before this kidnapping even happened. But like I said, they pay no mind to it. It's just like, man, it's just three guys digging in the dirt. What the fuck ever. But it also could have been a thing where, hey, I need fill dirt, and then they can drive in, you know, dig their own shit, and then get weighed out to take, see how much they take or whatever, because there, you know, there were some places around here that, like, concrete places, if you need, like, sand, because I remember going with my mom to pick up sand for the sandbox every year, and they would weigh her car and then weigh it when they came out and charged the difference for sand.
Right.
And it could have been a situation like that, and that's why they didn't pay any mind to them three guys digging out there, is my guess.
Okay.
So after seeing his mugshot, he has one of the most punchable faces because he's actually smirking with his eyes closed, and he knows as if his dad's money would get him out of trouble again, because he did have a record, because 2 years prior to the kidnapping, he was arrested for grand theft auto with two of his friends.
The same two assholes that he did this
yes,
with?
Yes, it is. James Schoenfeld and his brother Richard, James and Ron, 24 and 22 years old, were also... So James and Fred were actually partners in a used car business, and all three of them came from wealthy families. Oh, just fucking wait. Wait until I tell you why they did this.
Okay, I'm waiting.
Investigators did find a mountain of evidence that Fred Woods' father's estate in Portola Valley, an upper-class suburb of San Francisco, where they are all from. They did find one of the guns. They're written out plans along with how they would compensate if something went wrong, along with their ransom demands. The ransom demand was $2.5 million in 76, and it's $13.7 million today in 2024 from the state of California. They were going to ask for $5 million later on, which comes up to $27.5 million. And demanded to be dropped by an airplane into the Santa Cruz Mountains, which they were going to pick up later in the cover of darkness. They also found along with the guns and the ransom demands, they found fake IDs, receipts for the van and the trailer, the list of the kids' name and ages were written on the wrapper from either Jack in a Box wrapper or a McDonald's wrapper. They were going to give their demands to the Chowchilla Police Department, but weren't able to get through on the phone because the lines were jammed with calls coming in from hearing about the missing 26 children and one adult.
Uh-huh.
So they figured they were going to try again later, ended up falling asleep, and then they woke up and saw the kids on the news had been found. And they also found a Cadillac that was spray painted black, which I assume this was going to be their getaway vehicle. So Richard and Sean failed to turn himself in, while James and Fred, being partners in crime and business, would actually flee. James would be captured in Menlo Park, California 2 weeks later, and Fred would be captured later the same day by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Vancouver, British Columbia.
They went that far? Well, he went that far?
Yeah.
Okay.
So they had to obviously had split up at some point, or he got away after they were spotted in Menlo Park, California. Now, that couldn't be the case because he was caught later that same day. So they had split up sooner before that for him to reach there. So they probably had some plan. We need to split up, and then we'll meet in Canada where they can't get us.
So he was caught by mounted police?
Yeah. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
The ones on the horses.
Yeah. That's what they're called.
I know that. He wasn't even caught by a cop in a car.
They're the border patrol there. So it's not he was on a horse. They didn't say if he was on a horse. It's just their name. Okay. But I know. They just, you hear the name, the mounted police. You always assume it's on a horse.
Wait a minute.
Hey, he could have been, for all we know, he could have gotten fucking lassoed or some shit. It's like, we got you now, eh?
Ugh. Okay.
James would later stated that despite them coming from wealthy families, they were deep in debt and they needed multiple victims to get multiple millions of dollars. And we picked children because children are precious. The state would be willing to pay ransom for them and they don't fight back. They're vulnerable. They will mind. I already see your irritation starting and we're not even got to the best part yet.
It gets better. Great.
So this is the one part. So they all planned to use some of this money to fully restore a mansion built in 1867 and make it their home. That was part of their plan, other than them being in debt. They were going to use some of the money to restore a mansion built in the 1860s. When I read that little detail, I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
Yep.
That's why I got to do this story, because I know this is going to irritate the shit out of Sarah, and we're not done irritating her yet, everybody.
Great.
All three of these dipshits would actually plead guilty to 27 counts of kidnapping, but not guilty to 8 counts of bodily harm, because in the state of California at this time, this came with a mandatory sentence of life without parole. They were tried and were still sentenced guilty on the counts of bodily harm and given life without parole. Some of the children did testify about the physical and emotional trauma they were suffered from the kidnapping that caused them to have night terrors afterwards. Joan Brown, the mother of Jennifer Brown, which was also interviewed, but she didn't have a whole lot of things they could use, said that when Jennifer was 9 years old, at the time, she would come running and screaming into their bedroom at night, and she wasn't even awake, and she had dreamed that they were being all lined up and shot.
The fuck?
Larry Park would also say in one of the videos was that he had dreams of falling down a hole and couldn't get out of screaming for his mother in the middle of the night. So here's where you think our story would end. Okay, so life without parole, right?
Yep.
Well, that's not the case. Their original sentencing was overturned with their attenuation. When their attorneys filed for appeals because their original sentences did not meet the criteria for bodily harm charges and kids only suffered cuts and bruises.
That's still bodily harm.
They also the mental and physical trauma, like at the law time of the law, they didn't meet the criteria, which I forgot to look up to see what it was. So these fucking three dipshits were resentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole.
Great.
Richard Schoenfeld was released in 2012 at the age of 57, and his brother James was paroled in August 2015 at the age of 63. Fred Woods, unfortunately, would be paroled in August of 2022 at the age of 70, after he was found breaking prison rules multiple times by having cell phones and pornography while serving a sentence. Oh, and not only that, he was running a business from prison. In 2016, after his workman's comp lawsuit was filed against him, he was running a coal mine and a car dealership. Without prison notifying prison authorities. So that's against rules because he probably would have notified them, which I'm assuming that's why it was worded this way, that it could have been a different story. There was a study done on all the children that were kidnapped, and they found that many of them had suffered from panic attacks, nightmares involving the kidnapping charges, and changes to their personality. Many of them developed fear of cars, the dark, the wind, mice, dogs, and the kitchen and hippies. And I tried to look into this further to get more details on all that list, but I couldn't find anything.
Like the wind?
That's what it said. The wind, it could be because of the sound of the fans inside the trailer trigger a PTSD kind of thing with it, maybe. But the hippies, I don't get. And that's what I wanted to find out most about.
Did you see a picture of these three assholes?
Yes.
Did they look like hippies?
They kind of look like your typical 70s guy with the long parted hair, basically.
Like a hippie.
Yeah, like when you think, I think hippie, I'm thinking like longer hair.
Uh-huh.
You know, kind of like the teacher from Beavis and Butthead, like the longer hair almost down his back. That's what I'm thinking, but not like the part, you know, that most guys in the 70s had. That's like mostly what it was, but not like super long. One of the survivors did end up shooting at a car with a BB gun that happened to just break down in front of their house. That's how paranoid they had became from this incident.
I mean, good thing it wasn't any type of real gun.
Right. Many of them did suffer some kind of psychological trauma from all of this.
I bet.
For at least 25 years. And a lot of them also dealt with substance abuse. Michael had told 48 Hours was, you know, that one of the videos I did watch, that he got drunk and blacked out at the age of 18 and woke up at 48. So he went from 18 to 48 dealing with alcoholism and other substance abuses. But he is now clean and sober and is a long haul truck driver now.
Well, good for him.
The city of Chowchilla honored Ed Ray by naming a park after him and making his birthday Ed Ray Day.
Ed Ray Day.
Which they didn't specify what day when the day is.
Of course.
In 2016, the surviving children settled a lawsuit against their kidnappers and their estates and received a payout that was not disclosed, but one of them did say it was enough to pay for some serious therapy, but not enough to pay for a house.
But these fucks came from money.
Yeah. Like, Fred Wood, it was actually a lawsuit put against the Fred Wood estate because he inherited like $100 million from his parents when they died. Yeah, his trust, inheritance, trust, whatever you want to call it, the same thing. Even though he's in prison, and now all three of them are fucking out. Even one of the survivors said that even after he did get cleaned up, he actually learned to forgive them afterwards because he didn't want to harbor that hate in his life anymore because he found God. He's a volunteer preacher now as well. At the time of the recording, the video was done.
Yeah.
So through religion, he found the strength to forgive them. And there was photographs of him shaking hands with one of them. And I know some people would be able to, some people wouldn't. But he found the strength through God, basically, to learn to forgive, but not forget what they done. You're not going to forget what they done, but still to forgive them for what they did.
Right. I don't know. Well, wouldn't be me.
Right. But that's the Chowchilla kidnap busing in 19. Bussing.
Kidnap bussing.
Yep. I mean, they did bus them from one location to another, so there is that, but the Chowchilla school bus kidnapping in 1976.
Very interesting.
So hopefully that irritated Legit a little bit with the outcome of that.
Oh, it did a little. Good. Just a little bit.
You guys are welcome. Because I mean, I know at least one of you got so irritated.
I'm sure you could hear it in my voice.
Because I do know one of you guys did get so mad at the story she did last, that they actually started working faster because of how pissed off you were making them.
Yeah. Well, but I made them more productive. So in essence, you're welcome.
Yeah. Tell your employer to thank us.
Yeah. Do that.
But that's it. That's all that. And Ginger's getting super mouthy.
Ginger bitch.
But she always is.
Yep.
But anyhow, you ready to get out of here for the day?
Yes, I have
nothing else to add it on there.
Me neither.
I don't either. So until next time,
remember to creep it real.
All right, bye.
Okay, bye. Join our Facebook group by searching Macabre Emporium. Like and subscribe on YouTube at Macabre Emporium Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Macabre Emporium. And if you have any stories of the paranormal, your local true crime, or weird history that you would want us to look into and possibly do an episode on, email us at macabreemporiumpod@gmail.com. Remember to follow, rate, like, review, and share whenever and wherever you can and help us grow our little baby podcast.